This recording is a production of Faith Builders Resource Group. This presentation was recorded at Teachers Week 2022, held at Faith Builders on August 2 through 5.
But good morning. It's good to be here. I have to thank Peter for inviting me, persuading me to come here. And I'm going to be talking on science as a way of learning, you know, a scientist's perspective on the history and practice of science. So, as in the description, I'm a research scientist. I work for an agricultural research company in Hamburg, Pennsylvania. So I want to start by clarifying some basic definitions of what I'm talking about when I say science. So in the dictionary, science usually has a number of definitions. In my Webster's dictionary, the definitions mostly have something about systematized knowledge. And to me, you could split this into two parts. So the one is the knowledge that's obtained from the system of science, what you might call the scientific facts. And the other is the method or the system by which the knowledge is gained. And when I think about science, I'm mostly thinking about the method, because that's the context for the knowledge. And I'd certainly think that that's how it should be thought about, and I'm assuming most of you think at least somewhat in that way. I think it's almost like the difference between understanding or memorizing what a text says and being able to read the text for yourself. With respect to teaching, it's actually fairly easy to tell someone what a certain text says. You know, this is what the words say. It's actually a lot harder to teach someone how to read the text. But again, I'm hoping you would all agree that it's a lot more useful to a student to be able to read the text, than to just tell them this is what it says. I think the goal should be for a science teacher to teach the methods of science and not just the facts, these are scientific facts. And the result, hopefully, is that if you understand the method, then you're in a better position to determine how reliable any purported scientific facts are, or scientific knowledge is. And I'm not saying that if you know the method, you can test every hypothesis out there. It's just kind of like reading. Even if you know how to read, you're never going to read all the books that are out there. But you have a certain framework with which to help determine how reliable scientific knowledge is. And another way of saying this is that the context matters. The context, if say science has concluded this, okay, under what context did they conclude this? And I think the same dynamic is at play here in my presentation. You know, you might wonder what the conclusions of my talk are, and I could just say, here's the bullet points, here you go, and it could be over in, you know, a few minutes. And it's Friday, maybe you'd all enjoy that. But you'd lose the context. There's questions that I'm guessing you're asking, you know, just, you know, who am I? How did I arrive at the conclusions I arrived at, and why do I hold these conclusions that I do? So I'm going to try and give you a little bit of my backstory, a little bit of how I got to where I do, where I got to where I am, to give you a little more context for what I'm saying here. So briefly, I grew up on a farm in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania, in a Old Order Mennonite Groffdale Conference community. I attended a one-room schoolhouse 8 years before I moved on to more vocationally oriented jobs on an uncle's dairy farm, and then a neighboring dairy farm, and then some construction work at the home farm. And I was curious. I would say I'm a bit absent-minded, easily distracted, love to read. And I was especially fascinated by the plants and soils on the farms. And I would read a fair amount on those topics. And in my 20s, that fascination kept growing, and I wanted to move beyond just the farm magazine level of information about plants and soils. So I purchased a few books that I would say were probably beginner college level. And one of them was a book on soil science. And in this one of the early chapters, it had a chemical equation, and I did not know how to read that. I didn't know what it meant. But, you know, okay, I read a lot of things that I don't fully understand. So I just kept reading through the chapter because I thought the rest of the chapter might give me enough of context that I still get the point. But unfortunately, the whole rest of the chapter just kept referring back to the chemical equation. Like, as you can see in the chemical equation, therefore this, this, and this. And I soon saw that unless I understand the chemical equation, I'm never going to get the point of the chapter. So I bought a book on chemistry, kind of a teach-yourself chemistry type of book, and I studied that. And, you know, the first parts of that were okay, but I distinctly remember I got to this chapter on a valence shell electron pair repulsion theory, and it didn't make sense. There were just parts of that I couldn't get. And it was frustrating because I just had some questions about it, and I was sure there were answers to my questions, but I didn't have anyone to ask. And that was kind of a very, very pivotal moment where I realized that I'm either going to have to resign myself to never knowing these things, or I'm going to have to find a teacher. And a teacher for that type of topics is at college. I mean, that's where those teachers are. And as an older Ramenonite, which I joined the church that I grew up in, I'm an older Ramenonite, grew up to a conference, and that's, you know, going to college is not the most typical path. And so I wasn't quite sure how to do that, but I talked to a number of people through a series of connections. I had a guy recommend community college as it's affordable. I can just commute from home. There was the Lancaster campus of Harrisburg Area Community College is not that super far away. So I kind of tentatively, hesitantly signed up for some classes. I thought I'll see where this goes, and I loved it. One thing led to another. I got an associate's degree from community college. I got a scholarship to go to Bucknell University, where I completed a bachelor's degree in biology with a minor in chemistry. And then I learned about graduate school and the fact that good graduate programs actually give you a stipend. So it's like they basically pay you to learn. It's not a lot of money, but it's not bad to think that I'm doing what I love to do. And so I went to Penn State. I was happy they accepted me. I did it into their graduate school in the Department of Plant Pathology, and I did a dual title doctorate in plant pathology and biogeochemistry, which for me biogeochemistry was basically soils, but it was focused more on plant disease, plant pathology. And now I work as a research scientist at this small contract research organization. So it's a private company, and we do contract field testing for ag companies. So one thing you'll notice is that I don't have teaching experience in my history, at least not in the sense of managing a classroom. So I don't have any practical advice for you all. I have a deep appreciation for teachers because I would never be even close to where I am today hadn't it been for many, many, many good teachers. So I'm just going to give you my thoughts and experiences on the theory and practice of science, and as to how you go about to teach it, well, that's your problem, I guess, your challenge. I'll make a disclaimer here that I'd say very few of the ideas that I'll present, if any, are original to me. They're ideas that I gathered from my teachers, from my textbooks, from books, from other people. And I'll try and give credit where it's due. So I'll begin with a brief description of what I do as a scientist, and then move on to the bigger picture of science and some of the history of science and how it came to where it is now. And my basic take-home message for this part of the talk is that the overwhelming majority of science deals with very specific questions that scientists try to answer within well-defined frameworks. So in my work, we're primarily concerned with questions of product efficacy with regards to growing plants. So is a product effective? Does a product do what it's supposed to do, you know, like stimulate plant growth, kill insect pests, prevent or cure disease, et cetera, et cetera? And for its more specific example, there's a lot of beneficial microbes, beneficial bacteria, beneficial fungi that you can apply to your soil or your plant, and they're supposed to, you know, make it grow better, make it more disease resistant, so on and so forth. And so we run field trials on these beneficial microbes. And if you think about it, if you think of microbes in plants, there's an almost endless number of questions that you could ask about those topics. You know, like what kind of microbes are in the soil, how many are there, what do they do, how do they interact, so on and so forth. But of all the questions that could be asked, we're dealing with a very narrow, specific question. How does this specific microbe or these few groups of microbes, when applied to this plant, what effect do they have on plant growth or plant health? And also, the method that we use to determine this is also very, very well defined. For example, we always have an untreated control. One part of the field gets no treatment. Certain parts of the field get the treatment, maybe at different rates of the treatment or different timings of the treatment. And then, if at all possible, we have some kind of positive control. So we might have some microbe that we know has a consistent effect on plant growth. Or in the context of what we do, where we test products for companies, it might be the competitor's best product. So that's the positive control, the best competitor product, the company's own products, and then nothing at all. And then the way we analyze that data and collect the data, analyze the data, we have sort of this very well-defined method that we use. Also, you know, we never just do one comparison. We always have our comparisons, and we replicate it usually 3, 4, sometimes 8 times just to make sure it's a consistent result, and so we can do the statistical analysis and so on. So I'd say these are examples in my own work where I'm trying to answer fairly narrow questions using well-defined and established scientific methods. But what is the scientific method more broadly? And you're science teachers. I mean, I'm sure you've all heard the standard row about hypothesis testing. You know, you take an educated guess about why a certain thing works a certain way. What you call a hypothesis, you have some test for that hypothesis, and if the hypothesis is confirmed repeatedly, it might be formulated as a theory, and then depending on the context, you might even go so far as to say that it might be formulated as a law of nature. But the core basis is hypothesis testing, and this is true. I mean, I think that's a good way of describing it. However, it's incomplete. It's not the full story. And there's been a rather long debate among philosophers of science about how to really fully describe the scientific method. And there's a lot of literature on this. You could talk all day, read for the next few years, and all the stuff that's been read and discussed about this topic. So I'm going to simplify. What I'm going to say here is a huge simplification, so keep that in mind. But there's this view, broadly speaking, from at least the 1700s into the present, and probably even before that, which describes the scientific method in kind of almost sort of heroic terms. You know, it says that a scientist is willing to question everything and anything, and to hold everything up, you know, hold it up to the light of evidence. And in kind of a single-minded pursuit of truth, you're willing to discard anything that is not supported by the evidence. And I think it's a stirring image. At least it kind of stirs me. There's something sort of powerful about that. You know, be willing to question everything and hold it up to the light of evidence, and do this in just this single-minded pursuit of truth. The problem is that's not actually how science works. The philosophers of science make a pretty strong distinction between what they call normative and what they call descriptive. And the normative is more of how should science work. The same thing happens in Christianity. You know, how should people who consider themselves Christian act, you know? And then there's the descriptive part. Well, how does science actually work? You know, the analogy to Christianity. How do people who call themselves Christians actually behave, you know, like that, so on. And this heroic view is kind of, it's very normative. It's kind of, this is how it's supposed to be. But if you actually look at it, it's not how it works. You could say that the problem with this view of holding everything up to the light of evidence, discarding everything that's not supported, okay, that view itself is not supported by the evidence, is another way of saying it. And there's a rather small but hugely influential 1962 book called The Structure of Scientific Revolutions by a historian and philosopher, Thomas Kuhn, and he really drove this point home. The book is incredibly influential. Pretty much everything that's been written in the philosophy of science since then has been in some way reacting against against what he's written. But Kuhn drew a very sharp distinction between what he called normal science, which is like 99+% of what constitutes as science, and what he called scientific revolutions. So Kuhn says that normal science does not question everything at all, but rather normal science functions under a paradigm. So I'm sure you've heard the term paradigm shift. Okay, well the whole paradigm thing largely came from Kuhn's book, the idea of a paradigm and a paradigm moving and shifting. So the paradigm itself, or the framework you might say, in Kuhn's view, that itself is not questioned. And Kuhn would say that it's absolutely essential that it's not questioned, because if you question everything, it sort of descends into chaos. You have to have some framework within which you ask these questions of science. And he would say that he uses a lot of historical evidence to show that science works within a given paradigm until a paradigm starts to fail to make accurate predictions, or starts to fail to explain things as well as it should. And very crucially, there is a better paradigm to take its place. Only then is there like what he would call a scientific revolution to a new paradigm, a new framework. He has a lot of good points. He then goes on and takes it, I think, way too far into some very strange places. And the book is considered one of the influencers towards one of the things that sort of drove the postmodernist movement and so on. But the basic thing that he mentions, that normal science operates within a paradigm, within a framework, and that framework itself is not questioned. That I think is entirely accurate. It was sort of like a breath of fresh air to read Kuhn's book and to read this, and it just made so much sense within the context of my experience. And I would even say that in my experience in talking to students, discussions of really big questions is probably more likely to be associated with something like an existential crisis or something negative than to be associated with fascination or something positive. So far I've tried broadly to make two points. The first is that to really understand science, you have to understand the scientific method. And the second is that the standard explanation of the scientific method, which is based on hypothesis testing, is broadly true, and it should be taught, but it's incomplete. Because the hypothesis testing itself takes place within an assumed framework, a paradigm, you might say, even if that paradigm, that framework, is never discussed, and even if scientists themselves are not aware that they're even working under a paradigm, it occurs within certain frameworks. So what is this assumed framework? What is this paradigm within which this overarching paradigm within which the scientific method is practiced? And to answer this question, I'd like to go through a brief historical overview of the history of science, and just look at some of the frameworks, some of the paradigms that the early scientists or within which science developed. And I'd say the problem, and not that the problem, but the fascination, the parts about history is that it's often very messy, and our knowledge of history is incomplete. And it's often very, very tempting to draw a perfectly straight line to say that, okay, we started here and we arrived here, you know, just like that. When in reality, it's more twisty, turny, all over the place, and you know, eventually we arrived to where we did. And so keep that in mind, that what I'm presenting here is a huge oversimplification. There's massive amounts of material that could be read and discussed on this topic. Within all that messiness and the twists and turns of history, there are certain threads that you can trace through it, and I'm gonna try and do that without unnecessarily oversimplifying it, and these sort of themes that come through history can inform our understanding of the present. So for this point of my talk, I'm relying quite heavily on two books. The one is The Soul of Science, A Christian Faith and Natural Philosophy by Nancy R. Piercy and Charles B. Thaxton. It's a 1994 book. And also The Penultimate Curiosity, How Science Swims in the Slipstream of the Ultimate Questions. This is by Roger Wagner and Andrew Briggs, and this is a 2016 book. So, broadly speaking, the history of science, it includes some ideas from Greek philosophy and a number of ideas from what you might call the Abrahamic faiths of Judaism, Islam, Christianity. And Wagner and Briggs, the Penultimate Curiosity authors, they in particular, they really trace these ideas that developed into modern science. They traced them back through the Greek philosophers, and they point out that in 400 or 500 years before Christ, there were some Ionian philosophers that were beginning to push back against the dominant idea of their time that, and this is, I'm quoting from this book here, that anything that happened to the natural world could be attributed directly to the actions of one or another god. So earthquakes were caused by Poseidon shaking the ground, lightning bolts were thrown by Zeus, the sun was Helios driving his horses and chariot across the sky. And so they pushed back against that idea and developed had this idea that there was more of this, what they call this divine arche, that was behind nature, that was the origin of all things and whose nature was to encompass all things and direct all things. And they varied apparently quite widely in their opinions of exactly how this divine arche expressed itself this underlying order expressed itself in the world. But there was a shift in that they were searching for mechanistic models to explain how nature works instead of just attributing every aspect directly to God. And, pushing back against some of the ideas of God, you can kind of imagine where some of this might have led to. It was deemed impious, irreligious, to sort of challenge the gods in this way. And in some way, they were pushing God back a step instead of God being directly involved in nature. They were saying God is the force behind it. And they mentioned that in Athens, there was this philosopher who was condemned for impiety because he declared the sun to be a mass of red-hot metal, and he was forced to leave Athens. You just don't do that because that's, you're insulting the gods to even consider that there might be a mechanistic model for how the sun moves. And I'm pretty much quoting from this book here, but they mentioned that Socrates was strongly influenced by these ideas, but he tried to find a reliable basis, not just for the natural world, but also for moral action. And he tried to extend the underlying physical order to include an underlying moral order. And Justin Martyr, actually. Well, they say, according to Plato, Socrates developed a distinctive ethical position as described by Plato, that it was better to suffer evil than to do it, and that one should not return evil for evil. And they say that Justin Martyr, the first century AD philosophical convert to Christianity, described Socrates as a Christian before Christ, which I think is fascinating. Now, I haven't gone back and read the original Justin Martyr. I'm not sure what the context is for that, but I think it's fascinating. But so Socrates was not really a scientist, but he provided sort of the big picture framework within which then people who came after him could do their studies of the natural world. So Plato, well, I think, was one of the students of Socrates, and he had his view of the natural order and his idea of the world of the forms and more mathematically focused, geometrically focused. He had his sort of these perfect forms and the Platonic solids. Very briefly, it was perhaps a little more math oriented. And Aristotle, I think, was a student of Plato, or at least they overlapped. His was more of a observational, a little more biology focused. He did a lot of descriptions of plants, of animals, sea life, and so on. And he also had his idea of forms, which I think he meant a bit different things than Plato did. And there were others that came after them that develop some of their ideas. There was, you know, Ptolemy, Galen, others. But according at least to Wagner and Briggs, the dominant philosophies in the Greek culture that came after Socrates and Plato was not, what they say was Stoicism and Epicureanism, was not so concerned with knowledge but with what they called peace of mind or apatheia, which I think is rather fascinating. But anyway, science or the knowledge of the natural world, it did grow, but it didn't flourish. It sort of started, but it just wasn't quite the right environment for it to flourish. And then just sort of moving very swiftly through history, there were some Christians in the first centuries, fifth century, who wrote who were students actually of in some Greek academies, and they pushed back against some of the ideas of Aristotle, and then they had some great ideas of their own, and then you had the rise, or you had the Muhammad, the spread of the Islamic religion, and then there were some Islamic centers of learning and knowledge in Baghdad and in other places of the Islamic world where they would get they would have books from across the known world, from, you know, from Chinese to Christianity to, you know, wherever else, and they would discuss ideas, and they were writers within that world who had some good advances in mathematics, in astronomy, and so on. They translated a lot of the Greek texts into Arabic. And anyway, moving through by the 1200s in Western Europe, there was a formation of some of the universities like Oxford and Cambridge, University of Paris. There were characters like Roger Bacon were quite influential. There was just a number of things that happened that sort of led to sort of a mixing of ideas and sort of thinking of new ideas, like the fall of the Byzantine Empire. There were some scholars that moved from the Greek-speaking scholars that apparently moved into the West, and so the West was entirely Latin-speaking, and so the Greek speakers could brought in some ideas from the Greek texts that they had that the Latin world didn't have access to, and they. Around that, or the 1400s, I think, was the invention of the printing press, which, just as it was in religion, it was hugely influential for science as well. It started with religion. Of course, the Bible was the first thing printed, but they also printed many, many other things. You know, all the you know, early Christians, they printed the works of the Greeks and so on and so forth. You know, you'd characters like Galileo, Copernicus, and in the middle of that, you had the Protestant Reformation, and that, again, it's hard to know what was influencing what, but that seems to have definitely contributed to a rise of at least an environment that produced an environment within which you could sort of present or come up with new ideas about how the natural world worked. So with the Reformation, it's not just that, oh, this is how it is, that's what the church tells me. It's more like I get to read the Bible for myself, and I get to come up with some of my own explanations or my own interpretations. And of course, that can be taken, you know, way too far. But there's still something about that space in which you don't just have to say, oh, that's what Aristotle says, that's how the world works, that must be how it is. You get to sort of challenge that idea and make your own observations, and just. You know, a whole list of some of these early scientists, you know, Kepler, Francis Bacon, Robert Boyle, Isaac Newton, Blaise Pascal, you could just go on and on. These were all Christians to some form. They might not have been Orthodox Christians in the truest sense. They might, some of them had sort of strange ideas about Jesus, and there were some weirdos in the bunch, you might say, but they held broadly to a Judeo-Christian worldview. Like the idea that there was a creator God who created a creator God that was sort of a rational, orderly God that created the world, and therefore the world must be sort of a rational, orderly world. And yeah, just for the sake of time, you could keep moving all the way up into the more recent times. But both of these books that I mentioned here, they mention sort of the key assumptions, the key frameworks that these scientists were working under. The key frameworks, the key paradigms that made it possible for them to develop science into what it is today. And so here I'm quoting some points from Piercy and Thaxton. They would say that some of the key assumptions that these folks worked under were that for one, nature is real, which seems so obvious to us. But they say that there's some teachings such as Hinduism that says that the sensory world, the world of the senses that we can sense, is actually an illusion. Apparently the term of their Maya. And also that God made the world good. And sort of related to that, working in the material world is good as well. Work is good because science involves work. You don't just think about it. You actually go out and you perform an experiment. And that's something that for the most part, like say the ancient Greek, the philosophers did not work. Work was for the slaves. The philosophers just philosophized, and that's how they got to the truth. So there was something about the good material world and the goodness of actually working that allowed that led to the idea of scientific experiments and working on your obtaining knowledge through work. God made a garden, not a god. So, to quote them, God does not inhabit the world the way a dryad inhabits a tree. He is not the personification of natural forces. He is not the world's soul. He is the creator. And so they go on to say that as long as nature commands scientific worship, if you're worshiping nature, then dissecting nature to study it is impious. It's a threat to the gods. You just don't go there. A rational God, an orderly world. So there's some parts. I mean, there's some parts of nature that are sort of seem very very orderly. The sun comes up every day type of thing. But there's also a lot that appears very chaotic. But they assume that if it's a rational, orderly God that created the universe, there must be some rationality, some order to it. And with that in mind, they went out into nature and looked for the order that they thought had to be there. And also, the idea of a natural law or laws of nature. The idea of laws of nature was developed before they found them. It wasn't that they just looked at nature like, oh, wow, there's laws all over the place. No, they had an idea that there probably are, that there must be a law-giving God, there must be some rationality, some consistency, some laws of nature out there. And they went looking for them, and then they found things that they found some laws of nature. So that's Piercy and Thaxton in this The Soul of Science. In the penultimate curiosity, they come up with a very similar list. What are the features in what they call the metaphysical curiosity, the big curiosity that have contributed to the strength of science? And they use the image of a slipstream. Use a cycling image, which I did a lot of cycling, so it makes sense to me. But if you're racing with a bicycle, the first person breaks the wind, and then the other people ride behind in the slipstream. And the basic argument of this book is that science rides behind in the slipstream of the bigger framework, of the bigger philosophical, religious context. And so they say, what are the features of the ultimate curiosity that allows for science to develop or have contributed to its strength? And so they would say, there's the similar to Piercy and Thaxton, they say the idea of a single, beneficent, rational agency whose rationality could be both expressed in mathematics and read in the humblest aspect of creation. Kind of like, the one God who's out, creator God kind of type of thing. And the idea that this agency could not be identified with anything within the universe, but gave to the whole a law-like character. And I think they chose their words rather carefully there. They're not saying that you can't, go out in nature and sort of find God, so to speak. But you can't say that, oh, here is God. Like this tree is God. Or, oh, that light in the sky, that's God right there. Or wherever you might point, God cannot be identified with a certain thing, like that thing is God. And they say that the idea that truth is not the exclusive property of any single civilization, that's an interesting one, but I think it's true. A lot of the advances in science happened with a mixing of ideas. And there were some Greek ideas, Islamic ideas, Christian, a bunch of, strange characters tossing in ideas, and through all that, the best ideas seem to rise to the top. And also the idea that truth could not be imposed by force, but involve the right and even the duty of individual investigation and experiment. So those are some of the characteristics of the bigger framework that, according to these authors, allowed science to flourish. So, let me see how much time. I do want to leave a fair amount of time for questions, because I'm not sure when I'm speaking if I'm capturing your attention or if I'm answering questions that you never ask, or you know how that works. But I'll just move on to sort of my concluding points. And first of all, to really understand science and scientific knowledge, you have to understand the scientific method, or in other words, you have to understand the context within which the knowledge was acquired, to really grasp it. And that the standard explanation of the scientific method, which is based on hypothesis testing, is broadly true, but it should be taught, but it's incomplete. Because hypothesis testing takes place within an assumed framework, a paradigm, even if that basic framework is rarely discussed or considered in normal science. And that the framework within which hypothesis testing takes place comes from the broader, you know, religious, philosophical, metaphysical worldview. And in other words, you know, science follows after these bigger questions. And then finally, the broad framework within which science developed and flourished was, you might say, largely a sort of a monotheistic worldview. And especially for modern science in particular, it arose out of you know, Judeo-Christian, Islamic, what you call Abrahamic faith worldview and framework. Piercy and Thaxton actually asked the question, you know, knowing that science has sort of moved into sort of an agnostic, many in science have moved to sort of an agnostic position, you know, can it continue to survive without the basis within which it grew? And they don't say for sure, but I think they're very wise in that. It's very risky to predict the future. But yeah, it's kind of an open question. Maybe not. But if science continues to operate, it's going to have to operate at least assuming, even if it doesn't really have a basis for the assumption, it's at least going to have to assume many of the assumptions that come from a broadly Christian worldview. So that's the basis of the basic of my talk.
This recording and many others are available through Christian Learning Resource, the campus bookstore at Faith Builders. Order online at www.christianlearning.org or call 877-222-4769.